will call upon our brother Malcolm to give us the words of exhortation.
It was nearly time for Passover, and Jesus' family and the others in their village were making preparations for the journey to Jerusalem. It seemed rather strange that on this occasion, though, and the record is in the 7th chapter of John, that on this occasion Jesus did not seem particularly concerned and was not involved in the preparations for the journey to Jerusalem. And that was strange because Jesus was an observant Jew. Jesus was very concerned about the need to actually go to the house of God in the times when had been prescribed in Mosaic law. But on this occasion, he didn't appear to be interested in traveling, certainly not with his family. Now, why was that? Well, it appears that, if we go into the 17th chapter of Matthew, it appears that a little earlier than that, Jesus had begun to concentrate his teaching efforts upon the disciples. That there had come a time when he realized that the broad-scale teaching methods that he had employed in the past needed to be changed. That he had to do a little additional work, specifically with his disciples. That there was much that they needed to know. There was much that they still misunderstood. There was much that he had to do with them before this final Passover. It's interesting that in Mark's Gospel, the last week of Jesus' life is spelled out very clearly. Each day is identified as they go by. And so we know what happens from the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day. And we know the events that happened in that last week leading up to this last time when Jesus celebrated the Passover with his followers on this earth. Now, as we said, Jesus had begun to concentrate on the disciples. And yet it was really interesting that the disciples didn't really understand what it was that he was talking about. When we go, for instance, into the 8th chapter of Mark and the 31st verse, we find that there Jesus was explaining that indeed it was necessary for him to suffer at the hands of the scribes. And he said unto them, but before that, Jesus had said to his disciples, "Who do you think I am?" And Peter answered that question very clearly. Peter said, "You're the Christ. You are the Christ. You're the anointed one of God. We know that you are the one who is coming to save Israel." In other words, Peter was saying, "We know that you are the one who has been sent to redeem Israel and to reestablish God's kingdom on this earth." "We know that," said Peter. And Peter said unto him, it's in the 29th verse, "You're the Christ." And he charged them that they should tell nobody. Why? Why? Did he really mean that they shouldn't go around talking about it? What he probably meant was, shut up. Shut up. Why? Because at the moment, you don't understand what's going on. You only have part of the story. In spite of the fact that Jesus had been with them for nearly 3 years now, he had been teaching broad scale, and in the last several months, he had been concentrating very clearly on this small group of people that were immediately associated with him, that had been with him from the very beginnings of his teaching career. In spite of that, and in spite of the fact that they realized that he was special and had come from God, they didn't know what the ministry was all about. And Jesus was saying, in effect, "You haven't got it right. Be quiet. You may think I'm Christ, but how do you think that is going to work out in time and space?" And he began in the 31st verse to teach them that the Son of Man should suffer many things, be rejected of the elders and scribes and killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he spake that concerning openly. And Peter took him and began to rebuke him. Why? Why would Peter rebuke him? Peter recognized that Jesus was the Christ, the anointed one of God. Why would he rebuke him when he did that? Because, as Jesus had said, you don't have the story right yet. Be quiet. You don't understand what you're talking about yet. And then he turned around and spoke directly to Peter. And yet when you look at the record which is there, he turned around and he spoke to the whole group. They were all there, and Peter appears to be at the front of this group. He turned around and he spoke the words to Peter, but they were all there as a group, and he said, "Get behind me, Satan. You're not talking the language which God wants to hear. You're not speaking the things that are of God, as it is in the King James Version. You're not saying that." What were they saying? Why had they got it wrong? Where had their ideas come from? And why was it so difficult for them to understand what Jesus was all about? And we'll answer the question in a few minutes. But first we're going to turn the page over into the 8th chapter. And the things occur again. Same thing happens all over again. Eighth chapter of Mark. Again, 31st verse. And he began to teach them. Oh, no. Now we begin to 9th chapter. I'm sorry. 9th chapter of Mark. I missed my notes up. 9th chapter of Mark. But it's again, it's the 31st verse. And he taught his disciples and saying, "The Son of Man is delivered unto the hands of men, and they shall kill him. And after that he will be raised the third day." But they understood not what was saying. They didn't understand it. Now, something else had happened here. Something else had happened to introduce this. There had been a young boy, and this young boy in today's language we would say was suffering from a very severe mental illness. And he abused himself because of the illness, and people were afraid of what he was going to do to himself and were afraid to have him near them because of his very unpredictable behavior. Now, Jesus cured this young boy. The disciples came to Jesus, and they must have tried to do it themselves, for they said, "Why couldn't we do this? Why couldn't we do this?" You see, the story of what was in the disciples' minds is being increased as time goes on. They started out recognizing that Jesus was the Messiah, but rejecting the idea that he would be killed by the priests in Jerusalem. They started out with the idea that he was the Messiah, and one of the reasons that they recognized that was that there was a very large number of people in Jewish society who were waiting for someone to do just these very things that Jesus did, these miracles, all of them. And they're enumerated in contemporary Jewish writings. And we know that people recognized, were looking for someone who would come and do these things. And then they would say, "Ah, this is the Messiah." Peter had got that point. Peter had got that point. But they did not understand what was to come. They did not understand the trials that Jesus was to face. They did not grasp in any way the meaning for them in these trials. And neither did they understand what God had involved, what God had in mind by having Jesus fulfill his destiny in this manner. And it says there in the 32nd verse, they didn't understand. And probably because Jesus had turned around and said to Peter directly, "Get behind me, Satan," they were nervous about asking him when this matter was repeated. They didn't understand what he meant, but they didn't follow it up. Turn over to the 10th chapter. This time the 32nd verse. And they were in the way going up to Jerusalem. Now that's a little phrase which we find a number of times in Mark in various forms in our different translations. The word is not always translated "way." But it's quite clear that what is involved here and involved in the record that Mark wants us to understand was that Jesus was walking in a very deliberate fashion in a particular direction for a specific purpose. And we are being asked, in effect, to walk in that same way. So then they were there in the 32nd verse, in the way going up to Jerusalem. Going up to Jerusalem. They were amazed, and as they Jesus went before them. And he took again the 12 and said, "Behold, we go to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man, shall be delivered unto the chief priests, unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles, and they shall mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him, and the third day they shall rise again." But what do the disciples do? They still didn't listen. They still didn't hear. They still didn't get the point. For they began to say among themselves, "Well, we know you're going to establish the kingdom. We know you're going to do great things for Israel, and we want to be part of it. So can we be sort of sub-lieutenants, as it were, in this great kingdom that you're bringing? Can we be right behind you when you sit there and you administer justice and you take care of the affairs of state in this nation? Can we be right there beside you?" And Jesus said, "It's not for any of us to decide, but for God to make those decisions." And then in a couple of chapters, we find Jesus sending for a donkey. And if you look at the original prophecy in Zechariah, and it's interesting that many years ago when Brother Harry Whittaker was around, he made this point quite clearly for me, that there were two animals, a colt and an adult animal. And it said clearly in Zechariah that both animals were involved. And when you put together the record in the different Gospels, it appears that Jesus rode the young animal part way down the path. And then when he got to the descent of the mountain, it says in Matthew, the people began to cheer. Why? Because he changed from the young animal to the older animal and rode the stronger animal down the mountain. He fulfilled Zechariah completely at that point. And the people surrounding him recognized that he was indeed fulfilling this prophecy in Zechariah. He was indeed the one that they were hoping for, because they thought it must be this man. He had done these many miracles, and now he was riding into Jerusalem in all the triumph that a poorly clad and a group of ragtag followers could muster as they went down to Jerusalem. Now, Jesus went down the mountain. And again, there's a little phrase that Jesus went into the city. He went into the city. So he went down the Mount of Olives and back up the other side and into the city to the immediate east, immediately to the south of the temple. And so he must have entered the temple from the southern end. And it was at that point that he overthrew the tables of the money changers. What else was going on? What else was happening in Jerusalem at the same time? Well, the Roman garrison was on the coast. The Roman governor lived in Caesarea on the coast. It was a more salubrious climate. It was a brand new building. It was in contemporary Roman style. It was the place to be if you governed this area. And so when they had these major feasts and a lot of Jews gathered in Jerusalem, the governor would move from his position on the coast, take the southern route a little way, and then come to Jerusalem on what is pretty close to being the modern road from Tel Aviv up to Jerusalem today. And so from the west came the Romans. And this was a very different procession. This had all the pomp and the trappings of a powerful nation. This had all the show of a nation that had its own set of gods. This was a had all the show of a nation who knew their place in the world. They knew they were the best, and they knew that everybody should follow what they wanted. Caesar Augustus was the first of this line of Caesars. He, according to Roman legends, was sired by the god Apollo. His mother was the goddess Attia. And when he died, Caesar Augustus went up into heaven. And so in the Roman liturgy, this was the Son of God that was coming, who was his representative, who was coming in the Roman tradition towards Jerusalem from the west. And it was this Roman tradition and these Roman religions and these Roman laws and this Pax Romana, this Roman peace, which was brought about by the strength of the Roman legions, which was coming from the west. They came into Jerusalem and they took their position in the north of the temple in the Antonia Fortress. And Jesus came with his poor little group of followers, but with a similar sounding message, with the claim that he was indeed the one come from God, and he showed it with his miracles, with his claim that he was indeed the one who should fulfill those prophecies in the Old Testament. And some people recognized it, but did they realize what was actually happening? We know, again, from contemporary writings in Jewish writings of this time, that there was the expectation that there would be seven great battles in the end. The sons of light would win three of these battles. The sons of darkness would win three of these battles. And then in the seventh battle, the Lord himself would join with the sons of light and bring about the transformation of Jewish society and the Jewish temple and Jewish law and establish that kingdom of God once again. But you see, it was framed in the light of contemporary thinking of Roman power taking over things, Roman power subduing nations, Roman power establishing their way of doing things. And the disciples must have grasped that idea. Was it realistic? Yes, it was. The Maccabees had done it about 160 years ago. And we know that it was still going on, for when Gamaliel defended the disciples in 5th chapter of Acts, he again cites a number of minor insurrections which were going on. It was a way of life among those people. They were ready to take out their swords and fight for their freedom regularly. And this was what the disciples were thinking, wasn't it? That was why they didn't understand what it was that Jesus meant when he said, it's not going to be done that way. The Son of Man is going to be crucified. He's going to be killed by the Romans. But he will rise again on the third day. They didn't grasp that. They were looking at walking straight into a position of authority. They were looking at being transformed from this life into the life which they wanted, because they were poor people. They worked hard for their living. They were the people that lost their lands to the Roman overlords and so forth. These were the people that were suffering under the Roman occupation. And to step into a position of authority was a wonderful thought for them. But it was not going to happen that way. Some people understood it. Some people understood it. It wasn't until after Jesus had come back, he'd been resurrected, he came to them once again, in the day of Pentecost, it wasn't until then that the disciples realized that it was what Jesus meant and that they had to stand up and lead the new church. But there were others who understood, even at this point in time. And we have two rather interesting little examples given. And the first one is the widow's mite, which was in the reading that we had. It's interesting that a very poor woman is singled out because she was the one who would give what was for her a very substantial contribution. And her contribution took away from her livelihood. Her contribution would bring hardship in her life. But she understood that supporting the house of God was critical. Now, it's interesting that that point is put in there. Because when we turn over into the next verse, we meet another woman in the 14th chapter of Mark, who brought a very expensive jar of ointment and broke it. The jar was expensive. The ointment was expensive. So she broke the jar, it was no use anymore, and she poured the ointment, the expensive ointment, over the head of Jesus. Now, the disciples, and it seems that they all thought the same thing, even though the words are ascribed to Judas in another gospel, it seems that the disciples looked at this and said, what are we doing with all that money? Because this was the equivalent of months' salaries for people in those days. This was something which would take a long time, and it makes you wonder what she did to get the money together. Probably had what we might think of nowadays as a whip around, and we need this. So it conjures up the idea that there were probably more like her who were involved in this. It was not an easy matter to get that much money together, to get that much ointment. But she anointed Jesus against the day of his burying. Why did she do it? Because she recognized that what was involved here was service. What was involved here was not following the procession which came in from the west and with the Romans, all the ceremony and the pomp and the legalities and the military might which came walking towards the city at that time. That was not the way. The way was in rejecting every other thing that stood for and realizing that the answer to being with God was to not value any of those things and to go to the point of giving them all up if necessary. The answer there was to be with the brethren, to do what you could for the brethren when they needed it, as she did for Jesus on that occasion. The answer was in service and in the realization that everything that we have is given to us by God. In the 11th chapter of Mark, Jesus is found in Bethany. Beginning of the 11th chapter of Mark, he's found in Bethany. Why did he go there? He went there because there were families, and this is partway through this last week. He went to Bethany because Martha, Mary, and Lazarus were there. He had families there. But he had other places that he could stop in at as he was leaving the Jerusalem at the end of each preaching day. There were other places that he could go, and later on we find him in the Garden of Gethsemane. Why was he there? Well, nowadays we have this vision of a garden, like the Beauchamp's Gardens or something like that, that anybody can go to, and it's just open, and it's, for pleasure. But gardens in those days, and it's in the tone of the parable which we read in this morning's reading. Gardens in those days had walls. They had towers. They had security systems. They had gates, and nobody got into those gardens unless they were permitted. Those gardens were owned by people who were somebody in society. Those gardens were owned by people who were business people in Jewish world. And Gethsemane was an olive garden, and the olives made money, and that was part of the Roman system of commerce. So Jesus had influential friends, friends that he could count on, friends that would allow him into their property. But this was the thing which finally allowed Judas to know where he was going, wasn't it? Because there were only so many of those friends when Jesus left Jerusalem from the eastern side and went up towards Bethany, where he had friends where he could stay the night. Or maybe he would stay in a garden like the Garden of Gethsemane. And so his behavior was set and things were established for the final events of this week and the events which we remember. So what do we learn? What do we learn from this? Because that surely is the point to exhortation. Well, firstly, it's important to realize that Jesus did really value the friendships that he had in the meeting in his day. That they were significant to him, and there was a time when Jesus realized that he had to spend time with those who believed as he did, with his disciples, those who would go on after him, those who were important to him in this life and to the future message which he had to make. It's important then to make time for the people that are important in our lives. That's the first thing that all of these events teach us. But the next thing that these events teach us is that, and it's there in the fact that the disciples had so much trouble understanding what it was that Jesus was about. You see, all they were guilty of was understanding and recognizing what so many other people wanted in life. Common thinking, the way people valued their lives, the things that they wanted in life, the things that were important, and also the things that were taught in that day, because this idea of a final battle was very much part of teaching in Jesus' day. So it makes you wonder whether we should be a little bit thoughtful about what we read in our newspapers and so on. It makes you realize that when all that is around us, that what we really need to do is consider it and compare it to what we have in our Bibles.